During the course of this conversation, Christian Bauman and I were kicked out of a midtown dining establishment. The waitstaff detected that Mr. Bauman had written something approximating a rock and roll novel, and informed us that we could not talk in a civilized manner about such an ostensibly low art form. We regret any confusion that may arise to the listener during the course of this conversation, but it's something of a relief to know that rock and roll is still dangerous in some way.
Okay, so I am here with Christian Bauman, who is the author of Voodoo Lounge and most recently in Hoboken. Chris, how are you doing?
I am fabulous, Ed. Absolutely fabulous.
Absolutely fabulous in that sort of British way.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I wanted to ask you about the notion of what a rock and roll novel is. I mean, you have this particular rock and roll novel dwelling upon, say, Hoboken, as well as Mona Smith, who is this Erica Jong-like figure, who is the mother of Thatcher.
Right.
But I wanted to ask you about this because it's very fascinating to me. I have the belief that if you write a rock and roll novel, there needs to be some additional element, some additional hook, because if you dwell too much on rock and roll music, well, it's going to possibly be a little bit of a circle jerk. So I wanted to ask you, was this a consideration in setting this into Hoboken, or was this a matter of, essentially, the Hoboken aspect came first? What happened here?
Yeah, I think the Hoboken aspect came first. Well, first of all, I should point out, everyone keeps calling it a rock and roll novel, and it is actually a folk novel, so we should just be clear here. There's a lot more Woody Guthrie than anything else, but it's a good point. And, you know, the whole thing I wanted to do, in as far as I wanted to do anything, and it just didn't just kind of happen the way it happened, I was trying very hard this time to do two things. One was to write about a place, a very specific place, to the point where the place became one of the characters of the book. And of those places where I've either lived or been a lot in my life, Hoboken was one of them that stood out as a good place to go. And the other one was I really wanted to try to write an ensemble novel, you know, to the best of my ability. And I kind of failed in that aspect. And really in the tradition of like, for instance, actually it was very much what I was reading a lot of at the time was, which is bizarre because it's so different than, you know, where I go, but I'm a different kind of writer, was Penelope Fitzgerald. So like you're at Freddy's, you know, her other guy. Actually, there's parallels in the title between At Freddy's and In Hoboken, just as there is in Bruce Chatwin and In Patagonia. Those were intentional. That's where the title In Hoboken came from. And again, very, very different kinds of books. But the main thing was it was not really about the music that I was starting from. It was the fact that I wanted to write an ensemble novel, and I wanted one of those characters to be where we were, you know.
So really, it's more of a Hoboken ensemble novel than a rock and roll novel.
Oh, I definitely think so. It just so happened that, you know, my experience in my time when I was in Hoboken had a lot to do with music. So, of course, then that's where my, you know, shit came from. In the same way that, like, Ice Beneath Your Voodoo Lounge were based on places and things where at the time I'd been a soldier, so that's kind of the direction it went. Again, not that they're autobiographical, it's just where it went. So my time in Hoboken was a lot as a musician, so that's where this went. But that wasn't the starting point. Hoboken was the starting point.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I also wanted to ask you about the setting of this, which is somewhere between the mid to late 90s. There was one thing I observed in this book, it actually crops up a couple of times, is this reference to a paper storm. You have at one point Marshall watching the Manhattan skyline disappear. And when I read this, I was like, oh, he's kind of referencing the World Trade Center. And actually, later in the book, you have Bruno at the end of part one observing some snow that he confuses with paper.
Right.
So I wanted to ask if this was your way of deploying some chronological foreshadowing to make this time something that is essentially going to disappear or that is going to be replaced by a kind of new atmosphere and a new climate that is perhaps a little bit more hostile towards this idea.
No, I mean, actually, you're dead on. That is exactly what I was doing. And it's even to the point where the other character, James, his day job is at the World Trade Center.
Yeah.
And I very specifically put him above the point of impact.
Yeah.
You know, now, again, you're not going to know. I mean, you know, five, you know, this book is set in 96, you know, is he still working that job in 2001? Well, you know, you don't know. I don't know, you know, but I wanted to think about that. The fact is that to me, my whole Hoboken era definitely came to a crashing end you know, with 2001. Most of us were already gone by then anyway and had moved on and our lives had moved on. But when that happened, you know, I was out in Pennsylvania and our friends who were still in Hoboken at the time, they started coming out. You know, actually, one friend's Connie and Bob basically almost moved in with us for like 2 weeks, you know, just to get the hell out of whatever. So that really was kind of the end point. So I kind of, in a way, I mean, again, and you know from the book, this is hardly like a, you know, pre-9/11 book in any way.
Yeah.
But just those couple of little colors that I could put in almost, actually almost more in a kind of like tip of the hat way to my own circle of friends.
Yeah.
You know, like we all know where this is going eventually.
Yeah.
They don't know it at the time. So it's kind of, you know, whatever, but... Huh. But yeah, it was there. It was.
I mean, but
there.
There's also this notion of chronological foreshadowing in one conversation late in the book where the characters are discussing how they're aging and they're getting older and the like. So it seems to me that this isn't just a Hoboken book, but it's also something that involves this time is disappearing. But then again, one could also say and argue that, well, inevitably, if you chronicle a particular time, you can't have this notion of the Halcyon days disappearing. I mean, it's sort of a narrative inevitability. I mean, what are your thoughts on this?
No, I think you're right. I don't know that I have any extended thought on that, but there's definitely the question of looking at this group of friends who inevitably going to age. And of course, one of the big things in this book is the fact that there's a death in the book.
Yeah.
You know, it's a disparate group of friends, three of whom happen to be the same age, which is fairly young. But in that group, in that circle, there's people who are older by 10 years, by 15 years, you know, and you know, death is clearly upon them in the book. So it's something that they're thinking about, and you know, where do you go, and that not knowing of where that's leading.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was an intelligent response at all.
I suppose it does, and maybe we can talk about the notion of location as well. Being related to this time. I mean, you have Maxwell's, the Shannon Lounge,
right.
The Salt Girls Cafe,
right.
All of which I know exist, but I'm wondering how much of this book was invented, because you can't write a novel that is a complete specification of truth. So
right.
What did you do to invent, I mean, what wiggle room did you have for digressing from the specificity of truth?
I digressed a great deal, and actually in the first draft of the book, everything had a different name. I mean, even Maxwell's, I called something different, and eventually we put the name to Maxwell's back to Maxwell's, just because it so clearly was Maxwell's, it seemed stupid to name it anything else. So I called it what it is. But you know, I never felt the need to hold on to reality 100%. I mean, as with anything else that's fictional, you know, I take what's real as long as it's useful, and if it's not useful, I discard it. You know, as far as I know, there is no psych ward in Hoboken. You know, one of the big aspects of this book is the place where the main character has his job, and you know, and I get that information from something else in my life, but it had nothing to do with Hoboken whatsoever. You know,
well, the name Beginnings Behavioral Health is rather suspect. You know,
yeah.
well, I mean, but talking about this idea of where you draw from in terms of personal truth and how this translates into a particular prevarication or some sort of aversion of what you initially set down. I mean,
right.
To what degree do you need to have something specific to start from, and to what degree do you require a kind of digressive aspect or a kind of inventive aspect? I mean, you know, this is obviously a heavily Hoboken novel,
right?
But there's also this idea too of you know, I mean, it's not the entire truth.
No, it's not. And I mean, for me and in my work, I mean, the imaginative aspect takes... I don't know. I think I am a writer who does require almost kind of like a solid bedrock to start with. Almost every fiction project I've ever started has started with a very solid element of reality, truth, place, and usually something that happened to me. But then I tend to move left very, very quickly. And in the case of Hoboken, fairly quickly. And I think actually my catalyst for that in this book was the character of Oris, who's mad, you know. And I got a couple of things out of him. I mean, for the book, he plays a very key role because he allows me to explore in small ways the history of Hoboken in a different, interesting way because he's mad. So I can bring up and talk about this stuff as if it's reality, even though it's not physically there anymore, because in his mind, it is there. you know, and so I can discuss it in that way. But as for what he did for me personally, because I think characters do things for me as well as the writer. You know, if you're going to be in my book, you got to give a little something to me, you know. And for me, he let me be mad, you know, a little bit. And by being able to do that, I can let go of reality completely. One of the biggest struggles I had in my first novel was letting go of facts. You know, I wanted things, you know, if my story followed a certain arc from my life, I had fictionalized to a very large degree, but I still had trouble breaking the arc.
Yeah.
You know, and I got better at doing that. And Orris allowed me to do that. And just his presence in the book just allowed something to get tapped into that just allowed the madness to flow a little bit, you know, and just break that.
So in most cases, it seems, environment came out of character. I mean, I think also of the rivalry between the village scene and the Hoboken scene musically. I mean,
yeah, well, there's a rivalry between, you know, New York and Hoboken. That's kind of a low simmering rivalry. And then kind of that bigger one between New York and Hoboken together in Boston.
Yeah.
You know, Boston, you know, this book is, you know, we were joking before, it's a rock and roll novel, it's a folk novel, it's whatever it is. What it's about is, you know, the music aspect is mostly the large independent singer songwriter movement from the mid 90s, and Boston was actually really the center of that, you know, and really struggled with New York, because New York had always kind of been, New York and the environs had always been kind of the spiritual home of folk music, clearly Greenwich Village and everything else. But Boston really became that in the 90s. And so you ended up with this very, almost this sports world type of competition between, like, New York and Boston. That was a little stupid, actually, but, you know, but it was real and it was there. And it was kind of fun, you know, being in it. So, yeah, I tried to capture that a little bit about, you know, the attitudes of the New Yorkers towards what was going on in Boston, which in many ways was a lot more interesting than what was going on in New York, you know.
Well, concerning this as a possible time capsule, I wanted to bring up the moment in which Thatcher takes the stage, and you have King Papa saying, "Why does he play the room like that?" And this was interesting to me because you're remarking upon sincerity, and people are starting to have these ironic problems with it, or at least the notion of being ironic for irony's sake is now starting to develop, and we're going to see this become terribly steeped in 1999, like, you know, only a few years later. And so I wanted to ask you how concerned you were for these kinds of ideologies that were forming within this particular music world.
There you go. We're getting chased out of our table.
Yeah, okay, well.
Yeah, that's all right.
I think so. Let's try this again.
All right, are we back on?
Yes, we are back on.
We got duly booted out of the Moonstruck Diner.
I know, the Moonstruck Diner, which...
down with them.
If anybody needs to know where not to do an interview, it's the Moonstruck Diner at 38th and Madison.
Madison and now where?
Just so everybody knows. But anyway, back to this this question I had about this ideological time capsule of the moment in which King Papa says, "Well, why does he play the rubes like that?"
Mm-hmm.
And you were about to answer whether ideology was as much a part of maintaining a particular time or place, and this notion of a fixed chronological time that is, of course, foreshadowed by other events in the book, but also maintaining in this inevitable maintaining of time and place. How does ideology work into this? I actually have another observation I'm going to make that relates to this, but let's hear what you have to say.
Well, first of all, you know, I don't even know that I have an answer for it, because, to be honest, and I don't mean that as a cop-out, but it's like I did so little thinking on how I was putting this together. Initially, when I first wrote it, you know, it was a lot. Again, a lot of it was coming out, and a lot of it was coming out honestly more than in the previous two books, based a lot on, you know, walking in my own footsteps and then diverging where as needed. So that relationship between myself, between Thatcher and King Pappas, very much based on a relationship between myself and somebody else. You know, so the comments he made to me, comments I made back, they didn't have far to travel, you know, to get to the page. So. Thoughts about it and what I was trying to do were probably less than I would have done in the first two books. And it's very funny in a way. I'm almost just kind of figuring out now what it was that I did and why I did it. And I think I did a lot of things just kind of instinctively. You know, it's very funny. Actually, just the other day I was at a book club,
For this, but they had read this and we were talking about it, and it was one of those things that this has happened before where, you know, someone was like, oh, and that thing that you did, blah, 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 and it just made it sound, you know, this brilliant thing that you did, whatever. Yeah. And I, you know, of course, you know, my answer being very much, oh, yeah, I meant that.
Well, of course.
Yeah, I meant that shit, you know? And I was like, oh. Well, it was actually really cool though, and I forget what it is now. I wish I could remember. Because I was like, oh, wow, that actually is really cool. And I don't mean that in an arrogant way. Yeah. I was like, that's a really interesting observation he made. Sure. I had absolutely no idea, you know. And I think it was just because with this book, just the way it was and where it came from me inside of me was so instinctive. And I guess by book three, there's enough just I can trust my instincts at this point that I just kind of went with it. And I didn't have a lot of time for thinking about it post-book, because it, from the time I finished it and then it went into publication, there wasn't a lot of time you know, to dwell. And
well, it's interesting you talk about these real-life exemplars that you're drawing from, and yet I also think of Quatron, which sounds vaguely like quadraphonic. And I'm wondering if, in order to balance, I guess, real-life incidents that you draw from that are transposed, switched around, obverted, and the like, and you also need to have, I guess, I mean, did this character come from any particular person that you were aware of, or was this more of an, I had the sense that it was
Quatron?
More of a,
Yeah, well, he's, well, I mean, this is one where there's a stretch. Again, I think probably everybody in the book has a face somewhere in my life. Quatron is very loosely based, as in I don't even know the guy very well at all, an artist in Hoboken who used to be a lot of friends with a lot of the musicians there. He still is. He's a great guy. I won't say who it is right now, but I actually used his real name as the name of a bar in the town in the book. But it was really just his face and his body that kind of inhabits Quatron. I mean, I only knew this guy to drink with him a little bit back, and they didn't really know him at all. But so it was kind of his face, his body, and his occupation, and everything else is, you know, pure, you know, imagination on my part.
And
but,
that's very interesting in light of what you were saying, in light of what you were saying earlier about characters dictating environment. In this case, the character did really dictate the name of the bar here.
It really did. Yeah, it did. And it's so, in a lot of ways, there was a lot of that. There was these. I mean, there are very clearly characters in here who are based, although I may have taken a left turn later, on very people who were very real and alive to me. And then there's a whole slew of characters that are literally just based on faces that I knew, and I didn't know much beyond that. Beyond the face, and I just kind of inhabited them in my own way.
Really? Know? So really it's a matter of vaguely knowing someone and having only essentially this superficial face to go by, and then extending.
I'm so glad you said that too, because to be honest with you, that's exactly it, and to the point of even Hoboken itself, because I to be honest, I only vaguely know Hoboken. If I can be really completely honest, I never actually lived there. All my friends lived there. When I got out of the army in 95, my best friend had moved there, and I became friends with a number of his friends. I never actually had an official mailing address in Hoboken. I used to sleep on his couch a lot, you know. And then I played for a band in a number of years that had the name Hoboken in it. I worked at Maxwell's for a little while, but in the end, ultimately, I never actually lived there myself, and so I'm not an insider. For instance, I remember when we did the book release for In Hoboken, we did it at Maxwell's, and it was great. The place was packed with all these old-time Hoboken music people, and they really are Hobokenites, and I never really was. So in a sense, too, even the town itself was kind of just a vague familiarity with me. I mean, I loved it. I walked its streets for, you know, 2 years at 2 a.m. in drunken stupors, and, you know, I mean, there's enough of it there. And I almost wonder if, like, you can do a better job fiction-wise if you're not as intimate, because it is easy for me to make those left divergent turns, because I'm not as tied to it emotionally as maybe someone who is so engrossed in it. Like, I'm struggling with it right now. What I'm writing now is kind of set in the town where I live right now, and I'm again having that hard time of divorcing myself from reality. I didn't have that hard of a time with Hoboken, because I knew it, I loved it, but I didn't know it that well. I didn't know it as well as my friend knew it, for instance. So it was kind of easier for me to do it. And in the same way as characters, if I just have that face, I can go off on that left-hand turn.
But one can also sufficiently argue that if essentially this is what's happening, that, I mean, location doesn't matter really, that getting the feel of it right, it doesn't really matter, because this is coming from character, because this is coming from dialogue, because this is coming from specific faces that you see, and that are, you know, I mean, it's almost as if, well, the fact that this is in Hoboken really doesn't matter so much. I mean, and how do you if that's the case, how do you address, I guess, the hardcore Hoboken-ites who are going to start quibbling with a particular, you know, oh, you didn't get that detail right, or do such distinctions matter?
Well, I think on the one hand, you're right. I mean, in terms of character, in terms of the, you know, people, and talking about a book about relationships, ultimately you can put a story anywhere and get across those truths that you want to get across about people and how they interact with each other and how they treat each other, and you know, you can put it anywhere and have those same truths become evident. So I think that is true in that sense. Hoboken is important in the fact that in this case I wanted to write about Hoboken. So it is important for this book. I mean, I think I could have said what I wanted to say about this group of people. I could have said it in Brooklyn. I could have, you know, I could have had the same conversation about a similar group of people in Vancouver, you know, and had a similar book. But the fact that it is in Hoboken gives it something that it could not have had in Brooklyn and could not have had in Vancouver. And that's an element that I was looking for. Because there is something about Hoboken, again, even though I'm a distant lover, is something that I loved, you know, about that town. And in that sense, I hope I got those parts right. I knew as I was writing it as well, to answer your other point, that I knew that there would be those hardcore Hobokenites, and it's already happened, who are like, oh, you got that one wrong, you got that thing wrong. So I made my peace very early on that I wasn't going to get everything right, and I was fine with that. But I did try very hard to get certain aspects more in a soul way correct.
It's more of an intuitive choice in terms of getting aspects of Hoboken right. Because I want to bring a couple of examples up in this book that could just as easily have happened almost anywhere. Mm-hmm. You have two pages devoted to the worker hierarchy at Beginnings Behavioral Health.
Right, right.
Which is this interesting notion of who is above who on the employment food chain. But there's a passage I want to read to you late in the book that I really liked. And it's when Thatcher... I'm sorry, no, it's not with Thatcher. But anyway, I'll read it. It's, you can drink a lot on 20 when the drafts are a buck. Down in Virginia, there'd been a joint off post that did 50-cent drafts every Sunday morning from 10 until 2. 50-cent drafts and 75-cent cheeseburgers. Now that's living. You could pull yourself from the barracks around 10 on the Sunday, head on over, lay your change out in the bar. You almost had to, really. And to me, these two moments essentially encapsulate what the economic realities are of living in this way, that this, you know, Thatcher is saying this, or rather not saying this, but the omniscient narrator is. We're getting this sense of what it is to essentially live cheaply, and we're also getting the sense of where one's place is. But the great interesting aspect of this is that as the book moves on, we learn that this is just essentially being true to. I mean, these characters are trying to be true to who they are, but simultaneously there's this interesting socioeconomic description here that I just read that allows these characters to, I mean, yes, inhabit, but it's not, it could be anywhere. It doesn't have to be Hoboken. In fact, this is drawn from Virginia.
Well, actually, there's an interesting thing to say there. Well, first of all, the scene that you read is very funny. There's a couple of parts in this book where I feel like I was putting some finishing periods on some of the stuff that I had worked on in the previous two novels, that I, you know, just kind of tying up a couple of loose ends. Actually, the passage you read is one of them, and the first two novels, both being set in Virginia and in that army atmosphere, that being one of them, and the whole relationship he has with his ex that he goes into a little bit. That, you know, so there was a couple of like tying up of loose ends from the first two books there. I feel like, but in terms of it's very funny, about what you say about this being anywhere. I cannot tell you the number of times in the last couple of months, or even really in the last year, since people knew that I was writing this book and I would tell them what the title of it is, or since it's come out, I've been interviewed or something, where people say, oh, so you've written a completely different book.
Yeah.
You know, you have The Ice Beneath You in Voodoo Lounge and then in Hoboken, as if there's some dividing line between them, because... And it's just very, I mean, I understand it. I mean, I'm not an idiot. I mean, I do understand it, you know, because everything boils down to the 1 second sentence, you know, of a book description. You know, Ice Beneath You is the Somalia book and Voodoo Lounge is the Haiti book. And Hoboken is, you know, the rock and roll novel, you know, so very, very different books. And what I always want to just say is I'm writing about the same people I've always written about. Mm-hmm. Like, to me, they're actually it's almost like an arc. I mean, I don't see any difference between book one, book two, book three, except that perhaps I've written better as I've gone on. I mean, I see a difference in terms of how I am as a writer,
yes.
But in terms of what I've been trying to communicate and actually who I've been writing about, I've been writing about the same people all along.
Yeah.
It just so happened that they in those first two books, those people happen to have been people that made a choice at some point in their lives where they joined the army, usually for socioeconomic reasons.
Yes.
But they're the same damn people that inhabit in Hoboken.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Who have had different socioeconomic situations, or actually in the case of Thatcher, had the same one, and it's just a little bit later in their life, you know?
Yeah.
But I've been writing about the same people all along, and when I think about these, and again, like, I'm not a moron. I do understand why people see it that way. I see them as, like, almost three in a book, in an arc of books. I see no separation between these three books.
Yeah.
Because of who I'm writing about and what I'm interested in seeing about people, you know?
But in confessing this, I suspect that you have done something a little bit dangerous to your career, because now the people know that there's this locative context that makes one book, quote, different from another one. Well, where does the variegated aspects of these characters come from? If the location is different,
I do know, because you know what it is. It's age, because since I'm the only one privy to what book four and five are about.
Oh yeah, yeah. Yeah.
You know, and essentially, I mean, you can definitely see what I'm starting to see, and none of it's intentional. I'm starting to see what I'm doing as a writer, because of what I'm writing about now. You know, I'm writing now about a couple who's married and in their early 30s, and ultimately, are they very different people than who I was writing about in The Ice Beneath You?
Yeah.
Probably not, but the people in The Ice Beneath You were 21.
Yeah.
And the couple that I'm writing about now are 35.
Yeah.
You know, so I guess that's actually the difference. It's not just, you know, it's not just location, but what's happening to these people as they age.
Yes.
You know, yeah, because there's no question that even, you know, in Hoboken, they're older than they were previously, and not by much. They're still fairly immature, you know. But there's a big difference between 20 and 25, you
yeah.
know. And now with the doghouse, which is what I'm working on now, you know, they're 35, and there's a huge difference. But ultimately, they're the same people, you know.
It sounds to me like you can't really write a book that is too far removed from where you're at the particular time as you're writing the book.
Well, it's interesting to see. Well, there's two answers to that. There's a yes and a no to that. I think what I'm trying to do in my adult fiction very much is that. And again, like, I wasn't as aware of it, but I'm very aware of it now. I'm definitely working out my own shit in my own life.
Yeah.
You know, with this stuff. And before, it was stuff that had happened, you know, when I wrote The Ice Beneath You, it was 10 years after I was been in Somalia. You know, I wrote Voodoo Lounge years after I'd been in Haiti. In Hoboken, you know, I just finished, I was in Hoboken in the mid-90s, so it was a big gap. But where I'm now, that distance is shortening.
Yes.
You know, I live in Bucks County now and have a wife and I have two children, and that's what I'm writing about now, in one sense not, but so that it does seem to follow the arc of my life, and that gap is shortening. Having said that, though, I'm also writing a young adult novel that has nothing to do with anything, and is post-apocalyptic New York and two sisters and just whatever. So, but as far as I think what I'm, but that's I think what I'm trying to work out as a writer, what I'm trying to do as a novelist for myself, and what interests me clearly is that it's trying to figure out. I mean, ultimately, I'm trying to figure out a lot of the decisions I made and why I made them, and in many cases, I mean, that are very obvious. What would have happened had I made different decisions? I mean, the whole premise of The Ice Beneath You was about something that almost happened to me but didn't.
Yeah.
You know, the whole premise of The Ice Beneath You was about a trigger being pulled, and in my experience, I came very close but didn't pull the trigger. So that whole book was working out what that alternate reality would have been.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And there's a little bit of that in Hoboken as well.
But why not go beyond where you, Chris Bauman, are at the present time? Like, say, writing about someone who is in their 50s or their 60s. I mean, you know, there are side mm-hmm. characters in your books, but never a central character that reflects some future that you don't know about. Do you feel that you can't really broach a novel unless you have lived that particular age?
You know, I don't know that it's that, I don't even know that it's that complex for me. I mean, I think ultimately, I mean, we're driven to write what we write, and I actually don't know that there's a decision process there. I mean, you write what you're moved to write, You know, it doesn't bother me that I write what I write. I don't dwell on it, and I don't know that I spend a lot of time thinking about, well, could I do this or could I do that for the sake of doing it? I just know what I'm driven to write, and that's what comes out, you know.
Interesting. Well, there's one aspect of this book I wanted to ask, the notion of phrases such as holding for Mona that periodically crop up throughout the text. I read this book, and there's also a number of instances in which you take an adage or a homily and kind of invert it a little bit as well. That unfortunately, not one particular example comes to mind, mm-hmm. but this was very interesting to me because it's almost as if the text is this landscape of consciousness, of being a songwriter, of being hooked on particular phrases that continue to crop up. And I wanted to ask you about how, maybe so that it's not just a locative context, that there are other things going on, but on a prose level, how this free association reflecting the consciousness of the songwriters came about, or was this something you were aware of? Or?
Well, I think, I mean, I have to hold back a lot. You know, first drafts of what I write are, you know, very different. The songwriter and the lyricist is very strong in me, and where my head tends to go in a prose direction is almost more to, you know, if I wasn't a better editor of my own work, you know, this book would be filled with, you know, alliteration that sounds fabulous in a song that does not sound so fabulous on the page. You know what I mean? I think I am fascinated by phrases. I'm fascinated by repetition. You know, if you read my books, even on a larger scale, you'll see within them, you know, whether it's theme or character or dialogue, I'm interested in circular patterns in the way that I think lyricists, you know, are, and that still very much informs how I write now and what I enjoy to see and enjoy seeing in my own writing. And again, like I said, sometimes I actually have to force myself to pull back from that. It's another reason why writing Oris in this book was so pleasing for me, and actually almost something I wish it's not even a wish, I know I want to explore more, because I feel in writing his madness, and I say that, but I say that, by the way, in a loving manner. Those who read the book, I mean, Oris is schizophrenic, and I say madness in the most loving of manners, but in exploring his madness, I was almost able to write in a way that is really how things naturally come out of my pen without an editor. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Before I start editing myself. Uh-huh. You know.
Well, speaking of that, I actually wanted to ask you about the notion of reading some of this text aloud. I know that a lot of the chapters were versions of All Things Considered pieces that you read. And this was interesting to me because here you have this fictive hodgepodge where you're placing things like, you know, an essay, and all of a sudden it becomes a part of the Hoboken world that you're depicting in the text. I know you snatched writing moments while traveling and the like, but I wanted to ask you about this. Was this more of a hodgepodge, I suppose, than your other two books?
No, actually the opposite. The first book, Ice Beneath You, was very much a hodgepodge. That was born out of, you know, short stories and fragments and essays and this and that, and kind of put together, and it feels like a hodgepodge, very much so. In Hoboken, actually, there's only one section that was on NPR, and it was kind of it's in the acknowledgement. It says this part of the chapter was based on whatever. The real story in that is I backed into the NPR piece, not the other way around. I had written the chapter in question is about the character Thatcher.
Yeah.
He's a musician. He goes to get a day gig, and his day gig is being a records clerk at this mental health center. And I'm describing his kind of first day on the job and, you know, the accoutrements of his new trade, etc. And at one point, I had gotten a call from my editor at NPR, and they were doing, I forget now how this worked exactly, but it's something about a soldier's job after they get out of the army.
Yeah.
And it occurred to me that I had just written a fictionalized version of something that had actually happened to me.
Yeah.
I had already written it in the book. So what I went in did is I pulled that out, because as reading it again, I realized that it would make for great radio. It reads in a very, I go through this list of things that are on the table in this records room, and it's in a kind of very lyrical way. So what I did is I actually pulled this fictionalized thing out of the book, defictionalized it, told the real story of what had actually happened to me. That became the radio essay.
Yeah.
And then the fiction remains in the book. But it actually was in the book as fiction before it was the true radio essay. Uh-huh. But of course, the entire thing is actually it is based on the first job I had when I got out of the Army.
Interesting. While we're on this subject, I wanted to ask you about the notion of, well, I was alluding to it earlier with that passage I read, of having kind of a close omniscient voice. But I'm wondering if there was a kind of collection of various voices and all that. I'm wondering if any of this had started off in first person, because it often does read that way, and I can detect certain changes, I think, that were made over the course of this, particularly when you're talking about this when we were talking about, when I'm referring to this, the moment that we had just read, and also many right. of Thatcher's, you know, appearances on stage and the like, which are very first person, but not quite. You know?
Right. Actually, to be honest, no. I think there's one, just one small section of the book that came in from something else, and I think you're right. I think that was in first person, and I made the switch. The rest of it is all organic to this book, but there's no question that in writing through, and I knew this book had to be third person because, first of all, I was trying to write an ensemble piece. And again, I consider that I failed because it becomes much more about Thatcher than anybody else. I mean, I think there's an ensemble there, but there's still a leading man. So I knew that it would be third person, but I also knew that I really like very, very, very close third person. I like a third person that shifts over every now and then, you know, and lets that... Let's the first right in there. I certainly do it with the character of Oris. I do it with Thatcher. So it's not so much that I think that I had been making a transition or switching it from one to the other, as in the fact that I just kind of let the pen go sometimes and just kind of let that switch happen naturally as I was writing it.
All right, well, Chris, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure completely. Thank you.
It's always better on holiday, so much better on holiday. That's why we only